Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, Deputy Online Editor of The Critic, and today I'm speaking to J.R. Thorpe. J.R. Thorpe is a librettist and writer. Her debut novel, Learwife, was published on November the 4th and has met considerable critical acclaim. Jennifer was chosen as one of The Observer's top 10 debut novelists to watch, and Learwife was one of Waterstone's books of the year. Learwife is a beautiful reimagining of the life of King Lear's queen, a woman who is only mentioned once in Shakespeare's play.
So, Jen, your book is described as a reimagining of the life of King Lear's queen, but what is there to reimagine? We are told so little about her in Shakespeare's original play. I think the only time she's mentioned is in two lines in Act 2, Scene 4, I would divorce me from my mother's tomb, sepulchring an adulteress. So what exactly was there to reimagine, if that's where you're starting from?
Well, one of the benefits of coming from so little is that you can build a whole world. You know, it's kind of the freedom of having so little to begin from. And I suppose the real kind of shape of it came from the shape of Lear's family. You know, the very famous, the father and the three daughters, which is kind of posited as a complete unit in the play that everyone knows and everyone's seen. But there is this figure missing. And that absence, once I'd noticed it, niggled at me, and I couldn't get it out of my mind. And so I could create this person basically out of this idea of what role could a mother and a wife and a woman have played in creating these characters as we meet them in the famous play.
Yeah, it's so interesting because that's a trope that kind of appears in a lot of Shakespeare's plays, isn't it? If you think about Miranda and Prospero, where's her mother? And I suppose with, is it The Winter's Tale, where the mother comes back to life at the end of the play? It's just definitely something that he's really interested in. And I think you've given a beautiful voice to her. And in Shakespeare's source material, isn't that she is named, and the name, I don't want to spoil the plot for any of our listeners or people who haven't read the novel yet, but the name of King Lear's queen becomes quite a focal point of your novel, I'd say. Is that fair to say, do you think?
It does, yeah. It's one of those things that knowing it and the people around her not knowing it is a theme.
Yeah.
But in the source texts that Shakespeare used is the Histories of Geoffrey of Monmouth, which is a hilarious read, highly recommend it. Lots of kings and queens doing very, very strange things. But there's no queen in that either. So the story as it is has always been a father and three daughters. And I think, as in quite a lot of Shakespeare, it's this kind of shorthand for a family that is corrupted. Something about it is wrong. The plays differ in what is wrong, but it's a kind of a shorthand for something here isn't quite right. And that's where the drama is going to come from. Absent mothers do that. And in Lear, that takes a particular form of, oh, everyone is playing these elaborate games with each other about power and love and performance. And for me, I wanted to explore, what role the mother might have had in that kind of dynamic, that very famous the very famous first scene where Lear is like, well, tell me how much you love me, and that determines what you get. And it's very clear that this is not new.
No.
Everyone knows what role they're meant to be playing in this. And Cordelia decides that she doesn't want to anymore. And that's how it all starts.
Yeah, I think that idea of an absent mother being kind of a corrupting influence is so interesting with a lot of the Shakespeare thing. If you think about the absence of femininity with Lady Macbeth being, she's not a mother, she's not an absent mother, she just isn't, because of the whole absence of children aspect of that. And when I was reading your novel, I kept getting overtones of Macbeth, and I'm not quite sure why that was. I think it was the yours is an abbey, but the castle very far north up somewhere in the England or Scotland, and then a sense of isolation and cold and brutality. Did you have that Shakespeare play as well hovering over your imagination, do you think?
Interestingly, and my Spotify will testify to this, I was listening on repeat to the soundtrack of the 2016 Macbeth with Michael Fassbender. It was directed by, so it's the Kurtzel brothers, who are Australian, and the soundtrack is done by the director's brother, Jed Kurtzel. And it is this brilliant, really brutal, really strange soundtrack with lots of bagpipes and wailing. And it gets you into this mind space of, oh, people in a medieval period doing faintly savage things. And so that was sort of the thematic undercurrent. I am the only person probably in this hemisphere who had that as their Spotify most listened to for the entire of 2019, 2020. but yeah, it's this sort of, the power hungry woman, which is kind of Lady Macbeth is the sort of the prototype for, that was sort of on my mind as a thing that I wanted Leah Wife to be very nakedly, openly after power and not apologetic for it. She thought she deserved power. She believes firmly that that is her right, and she's going to do what she thinks she should to get it.
Yeah, yeah. Which is really interesting and fits in with the very Shakespearean themes of all of his other kind of history plays as well, like the naked grab for power. Working with such a famous source material as King Lear, maybe the most famous Shakespeare play, did you find that daunting or intimidating in any way?
Someone asked me whether I did a lot of like dives into Shakespearean scholarship. And the thing about Shakespearean scholarship is there is so much of it that you will rapidly get really overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So if I noticed something thematically and wanted to make sure that I was understanding it, I went and did a bit of research, but mostly I just reread the play and reread the play and reread the play. There was a point where I probably could have recited it to you and been that really boring person at parties. Yeah.
I think that's the best person to be at parties. Yeah.
But in a way, it was also comforting because I knew that so many people would come to the book knowing, in a way, kind of who these people are in adulthood. There is at the beginning, the front page is a summary of the play. So if you haven't read the play or don't know anything about it, it is in there. It's not necessary to have read it. But there was also this nice thing of, oh, people will know. People will have understood who Lear is and who these children are. And so I can kind of go from this almost position of familiarity. And that was nice.
Yeah, yeah. And did you find any like lines of the play reappearing in your own voice or in Lear Wife's voice, do you think, in the text?
A lot of the focus on nothing.
Yeah, I was going to say the nothingness.
Yeah.
Quite hard
that
to
was really
avoid.
It is quite hard to avoid, yeah. Nothingness and kind of the idea of zero and the kind of what happens when everything is taken away, basically, is what I went with. So the novel begins at the end of King Lear, when everyone is dead. That's not a spoiler. Everyone aside from Kent, Lear's loyal servant, is dead. And the novel begins with Lear wife, Lear's queen and the mother of these three girls, finding that out. And so she's coming from a position of immediately nothing at the beginning of the novel. And I kind of wanted to explore, what does that look like? What does that feel like? And that harkened back to a lot of stuff in the play about Lear basically losing everything through his own stubbornness, losing his crown, losing the love of his daughters, losing his sanity. And it was this kind of this parallel narrative that I was trying to build. So yeah, there were a lot of echoes all the way through, I think.
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating, the idea of nothingness. One of the images I found most memorable in your novel was when Lear Wife is touching her stomach and remembering that children and babies were in there and now there is nothing in there. But not only is there nothing in there, they're not even in existence anymore. That complete image of both the nothingness of her motherhood has kind of gone, as well as the female line, and also her very noble ancestry has also ended. And I wondered what you thought about that.
Well, it's one of those, a lot of people have observed this before me, that there's no word in English for a woman who was a mother but her children have died. We don't have an equivalent for widow or widower or anything like that. And so there's kind of a linguistic gap there as well. There's an absence of language in it, being able to talk about it. And that was kind of what I wanted to bring across in that moment, is that, you know, there's so much loss in that experience that it's so difficult to be able to wrap your head around. And so much of the novel is about her trying and failing to understand what it is and who she is now.
Yeah, a really difficult task to come to terms with. Yeah. And so if we're going to talk about how haunting your central character is, Lea Wife, is, I think one of the things that really stuck with me the most is her very distinctive first person voice that you managed to create and weave through the whole of the novel. And it goes back to her life before Shakespeare's play, during Shakespeare's play, when the daughters are all very young, and then a long time afterwards. How did you manage to weave so much history together and imagine things both pre and post Shakespeare's play in such a convincing manner?
A lot of work. extremely good editors. I think, as you say, it was very helpful to have this very, very clear voice very early on, because that establishes a perspective. So you know what they're going to notice in a scene, you know what they're going to prioritize. But it was very important for me to have the whole of her life. And she's a difficult character, but I wanted to make it clear that she was a character who has a lot of tenderness as well as a lot of brutality. You know, she remembers really beautiful little scenes with her daughters as well as really, really harsh ones. She has this kind of rounded relationship with Lea at the same time as, you know, them playing really horrible games with each other. That was sort of the real difficulty of building up who she was as a person, came from trying to get that range of emotional experience in her memories so that people could look at her and go, oh, this isn't just a tragic character or a vicious character or a caricature of what a powerful woman is. I wanted her to feel real, to feel like a real woman with real depth and complexity. And that's where the comprehensiveness of the memories and of her life in the Abbey came from.
Yeah, yeah. There's also something very, very musical about the way that images and her dreams repeat throughout the book. And so by the end, as her memory is failing and she's getting confused between what's dream and what's real, you have a very, very convincing sense of what you know she is imagining, because you've repeated it earlier on in the novel. So as well as being a novelist, you're also a librettist. I wondered if you think there's anything musical in the way you've used refrains in her voice and in the structure of the text.
Oh, definitely. One thing about being a librettist is it teaches you the importance of rhythm and repetition and the idea of bringing something forth, even if it's very subtle the first time, repeating it, producing it in different ways, giving it to the audience in, you know, over time in ways that change and alter. And that definitely affected the way that I wrote it, because also a lot of human consciousness, I think, it does follow rhythms. It follows a kind of weird musicality of its own.
Yeah.
And when memory is involved, you know, there is, and Lea Wife, the way I wrote her, she's a very lyrical thinker. She's very visual. She kind of sparks lots of different things from seeing very small aspects of her environment. And so having the kind of the librettist background meant I could go, okay, this is a way to work this scene, you know, to kind of have this repetition move us through it.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, someone comes in and opens a door or someone has an important speech or something, the rhythm of her own thoughts kind of propels us forward.
Yeah, yeah, because there's so little action in like the very stereotypical sense of like plot and that type of thing. Everything is more internal. I think it works really, really well. There is something quite operatic about it. It could be an opera.
I am not putting it in. Someone else can do it. What I said about screenplays as well is I think it would be a really interesting film, but I am not doing it. Someone else can do it.
It would be a brilliant, brilliant film. Yeah, it'd be really interesting. So if we're going to talk about how Lea Wife ends the novel with a kind of sense of fading memory, and King Lear very, very famously goes very, very mad at the end of the play. And I wondered if you thought there was symmetry between, for me, the portrait of Lea Wife's madness at the end of the novel felt dementia-like. I don't know if that's too modern a term to put on it, but the idea that short-term memory has kind of gone, but long-term memory is resurfacing and with no control over it, and it's difficult to tell the difference between what's old and what's new. So how did that compare or contrast to the quite different type of madness that King Lear experiences?
Well, the advantage of having a novel as opposed to a play is that you have this opportunity, you have more space, you have more length. And a lot, I mean, I've seen a bunch of different really great interpretations of Lear's madness on stage. And there is this really interesting, people will take it in different ways. Some of them will take it the dementia route. Some of them will take it the very aggressive, you know, jumping all over the place, very energetic. And the play gives you lots of space to do that. But I thought that because we'd spent so much time with Lear Wyfe as a person with real memories and real kind of thoughts, it made sense to articulate her drifting off in a way that we'd be able to connect to, as opposed to this really kind of dramatic throwing things off battlements or whatever, which can be, is fantastic to watch on stage, but I think would have been a bit alienating if I tried to make that kind of what had happened to her. And in a way also, her madness is a kind of refuge in the end, because, you know, it's not really a spoiler to say that things don't work out really for her in the way that she was planning. And she makes some really terrible discoveries, but it's kind of okay because out of everyone, she survives and she kind of retreats into this lovely dementia-like state where sometimes the people that she loves feel like they're still alive. And in a way, that's safe.
Yeah, it's incredibly moving as well. Like, it's really tragic. I think we so often take Cordelia's death or the plot of King Lear and you kind of almost forget it's a tragedy, which is the bizarrest thing to say because it's the most famous tragedy in the world, but you forget that there's a real human deaths in a way. I mean, I know they're made up, but there's a very strong sense in your novel that that happens to a real person, which is brilliant. So again, without spoiling the plot for people who haven't read it yet, much of the action of the novel is dictated by an outbreak of illness in the abbey where the queen is staying. So I wanted to ask, were you writing this this plague or this pestilence during, I mean, the modern plague, the pandemic, or were you not? Was it before?
It was before, and really? It wasn't. It was one of those things where, like, this novel was sold in late 2018, early 2019. It had been written at that point, and we were doing the last edits in 2020, and that was weird.
You're a prophet. That's
yeah, sitting there being like, ah, this is proof of concept. Oh dear. Looking around, going, well, does this conform to what I thought people would do in a plague situation? I guess it does. You know, it's a Yuda has opinions. It was a very weird experience, but yeah, I didn't intend to predict a worldwide plague. I'm sorry.
I don't think you caused it, but it is amazing because when I was reading it, I was convinced that the portrait of lockdown was kind of influenced by our own lockdown. They have passes thrown over the wall and then letters in quarantine and people coming in to look after their sick. But it's amazing that it wasn't in any way inspired by that. Yeah.
It was slightly horrifying that I had to then, yeah, look at it as an, well, it was also really, I felt really for the readers who might want to read this now, but might want to put it off for a little bit because quarantine has been really intense. So I'm not in any way offended by people who have told me, look, I'd like to, but I'm going to wait until we've been out of lockdown for about 18 months before I can face it.
Which is very fair. I mean, luckily we weren't all locked down in very, very remote abbeys, but yeah, with bizarre power games.
Yes. Also, I mean, so you hope. if there are any nuns listening, I'm sorry. It might not be you, but you know.
Yeah, I found the whole portrait of the abbey completely fascinating. The idea that all of the nuns were, they all had their own foibles and very, very human, not simply just religious devotional lives. How did you kind of write about that in that way?
Well, my husband is a medievalist. He specializes in medieval Italian poetry. So I had a lot of access to primary texts about life in the medieval period. And so I just went hunting for And that because abbeys were, we don't think about this, but abbeys were hugely important economic centers. They were very often very rich. They had lots of records. Lots and lots of people have written about what life was like, even if it isn't about the emotional life of, you know, nuns in those areas. It's still, it was very easy, I suppose not easy, but it was very, you know, accessible to me as a place to, okay, this is what the rhythm of a day looks like. This is what they eat. This is how kind of the light moves around this particular space. You know, it was, reconstruction was, wasn't that difficult. It was the psychological bit that was more difficult to enter into. What does it mean to be in this place as a religious woman in this very particular season, you know? But yeah, it was also this, the research was really enjoyable because you inevitably come across stuff that you cannot have anticipated, like some of the stuff that they ate. It's disgusting.
What did they eat?
Well, there's a scene in the book where I talk about I'm sorry, this is disgusting, but lamb fetuses cooked inside a ewe's belly. That's real. That is a real thing. I did not make that up. It's a genuine dish.
That is, yeah, it's quite brutal, isn't it? Yeah.
Yep. But they had very different ideas about brutality and hygiene and cleanliness and, you know, and class and all these different things that shaped the world that they lived in. And that was really important for me to be accurate about.
Yeah, that was the class dimension was what I found very, very interesting. There's one moment at which Leowife is describing how sweat is a kind of marker of how noble you are because it's how close you get to sit to the fire. And it was like little details like that that made the whole thing so real. Do you know if that was true or is that one of your own psychological insights, do you think?
The class thing was definitely very, very pervasive. That's one of the things that I think is often quite difficult for the modern reader. If you're getting into books like this, if the class system was really intense and it completely shaped the way in which people looked at the world, and it completely shapes the way that these characters look at the world, particularly Leowife, who fully believes that she is a queen from birth and so is born to rule other people. And that's just a fact. That's a fact of the universe for them. It's not negotiable. And so the pushing and pulling for power takes on all these other dimensions about class rivalry and rising yourself above your class and, you know, what it means to be aspirational. And all this stuff that we find very familiar but plays out in a really different context.
Yeah. It's really interesting, and you would think that the class divides would be less so in an abbey where everyone has decided to take themselves away from the world, but it's not the case at all.
Yeah, that was one of the really interesting things about some of the primary sources. Some of the stuff that noble nuns or noble people who lived in abbeys and didn't necessarily take vows, some of the stuff they got away with, truly amazing. Like silk linings in their robes, pet dogs everywhere, eating candy. And that was just a thing that was allowed. It was fine. They were like, yes, it was basically a retirement home for elderly widows. Like, and meanwhile, there are all these nuns doing their penance and going around in hair shirts, and like this stuff was real and it was taken as completely normal, even though we look at it and go, what?
Yeah, it feels so alien to our concept of what that type of place was, but I think maybe it's very different to what we imagined. Yeah, you have a lot of lines about the abbess using rose water on her skin, which is just a beautiful insight into like medieval skincare as well. So I think there'll be lots of people who see this as a feminist project, giving a voice to an unnamed, voiceless female character, barely mentioned female character in one of Shakespeare's most famous plays, and the only moment she is mentioned is a kind of like misogynistic slur, you know, an adulteress. Do you see it as a feminist project, or do you see it as something different?
Well, no, I think it definitely is a feminist project. I've always been really interested in books that take the canon, particularly the very white, very male canon, and flip it on its head and unpick it and look at different things about it. And the canon is ever evolving, is the thing. And these big stories have so much further potential to be worked on. So like Wide Sargasso Sea was one of my favorite books growing up, the the different take on Jane Eyre, and the Penelope ad by Margaret Atwood, and all of these things. And we're in this wonderful moment at the moment with, you know, The Silence of the Girls and Circe and Ariadne and these amazing books coming out where people are really hungry for female perspectives in what have been hugely male-dominated spaces in literature. And I see a couple of people have asked questions asking if I found that, you know, daunting or like we were all crowding up against each other. And I think it's like we're all riding on this wave of wonderful kind of feminist interest in, it's basically just an interest in female experience, in female stories, in the way women and people who identify as women look at the world and move through narrative. And that's really to be celebrated.
I think that's really true. And I think the way you do it is brilliant because it's not just like female psychological insight. There's a real strong bodily focus in your novel, which I think we're quite used to having in a male sense, you know, the kind of like male virility or male power, if we're talking about like a lot of the male characters in like history plays and stuff. There's a huge emphasis on their strength or their lack of in the case of Hamlet. And I think the way that you manage to marry both her psychological and her bodily femaleness is really brilliant. Was that a tension you were aware of as well? Or?
Particularly in putting forward a character who is all you know, very much about power and about appearing important. It was important for me to also include this bodily side, one, to make her real, but two, to kind of give her that extra dimension of complexity, because we're still uncomfortable talking about female bodies a lot of the time in a lot of cultural areas, particularly when it comes to body, you know, women who are meant to be doing powerful things or, you know, being in powerful spaces. And people are allowed to be vulnerable and have bodily functions and everything, and also do really important things. And the fact that we're still finding that difficult is a bit problematic. So, but you know, it's about her experience of the world, and her body is a huge part of how she sees things and understands things. It's also kind of her route into her memory a lot of the time. So that's why it was so important.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. Do you have any plans for any future female reimaginings of Shakespeare plays? Gertrude or an Ophelia would be really interesting, I think, but anyway. Well,
the next novel is actually completely different. So I'm going away from the medieval period for a while. It is about female experience, but it's about modern day female experience and about translation and the refugee crisis and things like that. But I've kind of been saying for a little while, I think Grendel's mother in Beowulf really deserves something. She really deserves someone to like go in and really give her a rounded narrative experience. I think that would be amazing.
That would be, because it's all about the loss of her son as well. Mm-hmm. Like that's a kind of, yeah, it'd be brilliant. Yeah. That would be really, really interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm giving this idea out for free, by the way. If anyone is like, yes, I'd love to do that, please take it and run.
Please do, and then come back on the podcast. That would be the best thing.
Yep.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to read your new novel. And everyone read Lear Wife.
Yeah, please do. It is out now. And in the audiobook also, if you are not if you don't have time to read physical books, the audiobook is by the amazing Juliet Stevenson, and it is absolutely amazing. Thoroughly encourage you to go out and get it. Even if you've already got the hardback, go and get it anyway.
Perfect. Everyone listen to it. Well, thank you so much.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.